28 hydrogen bomb mounted beneath the plane was engulfed in flames. Firefighters managed to extinguish the blaze before the weapon's high explosives could detonate or ignite. Because the accident occurred at a military base, away from the scrutiny of the press and the public, neither the American government nor the British would acknowledge that it happened. The Joint Committee on Atomic Energy unanimously agreed that the Jupiter missiles should be removed from Italy and should never be deployed in Turkey. The missiles seemed to pose more of a threat to NATO one way or another than to the Soviets, and placing missiles with thermonuclear warheads in Turkey, a politically unstable country that bordered the Soviet Union, might be viewed as a provocation at the Kremlin. The Joint Committee also recommended that the Mark 7 bomb either be removed from the NATO stockpile or fitted with a trajectory sensing switch so that a mistake by a ground crew would be less likely to cause an accidental detonation. Moreover, the current fictional custody arrangements had to be replaced with measures that gave the United States real possession and control of its nuclear weapons in Europe. A lone American sentry, ordered to stand on a runway for 8 hours at a time, was bound to start goofing off. The committee wanted at least two American soldiers keeping an eye on the igloos, the missiles, the fighter planes on alert. It wanted American vehicles and troops at every major NATO base capable of evacuating or destroying nuclear weapons that an enemy or an ally might want to seize. And most of all, the committee wanted some kind of mechanical device added to NATO's weapons so that unauthorized personnel couldn't detonate them. Harold Agnew had recently met with Donald R. Cotter, a supervisor at Sandia, about the best way to install use controls on a nuclear weapon. Cotter mentioned an electromechanical lock that Sandia was developing for atomic landmines. The weapons were essentially time bombs that NATO troops could arm and then leave behind to destroy buildings, bridges, airfields, or units of an invading Red Army. The new lock had originally been conceived as a safety device. Because these weapons wouldn't be dropped from a plane or launched by a missile, a trajectory sensing switch wouldn't help to prevent accidental detonations. The G-forces that a landmine would normally experience before being armed would be the same as those of the soldier carrying it, and the weapon might sit for hours or days before exploding. But a motor-driven lock inside the mine, connected by a long cable to a handheld decoder, would allow troops to arm the weapon from a safe distance. Agnew thought that sort of lock would solve many of the custody problems at NATO. A coded switch installed in every nuclear weapon would block the crucial arming circuits. It would make a clear distinction between the physical possession of a weapon and the ability to use one. It would become a form of remote control, and the power to exert that control, to prohibit or allow a nuclear detonation, would remain with whoever had the code. Agnew brought an early version of the electromechanical locking system to Washington, D.C. for a closed-door hearing of the Joint Committee, putting the switch and the decoder in the seat next to him on a commercial flight from Albuquerque. The coded switch that went inside a weapon weighed about a pound. The decoder weighed about 40. It was a black box with knobs, numbers, and a series of colored lights on it, powered by a large internal battery. To unlock a nuclear weapon, a two-man custodial team would attach a cable to it from the decoder. Then they'd turn the knobs on the decoder to enter a four-digit code. It was a split-knowledge code. Each custodian would be given only two of the four numbers. Once the correct code was entered, the switch inside the weapon would take anywhere from 30 seconds to 2.5 minutes to unlock, as its little gears, cams, and cam followers whirred and spun. When Agnew and Cotter showed the committee how the new lock worked, it didn't. Something was wrong. But none of the senators, congressmen, or committee staff members realized that it wouldn't unlock, no matter how many times the proper code was entered. The decoder looked impressive. The colored lights flashed, and everyone in the hearing room agreed that it was absolutely essential for national security. The American military, however, vehemently opposed putting any locks on nuclear weapons. The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Power at SAC, General Norstad at NATO, all of them agreed that locks were a bad idea. The always-never dilemma lay at the heart of military's thinking. No single device can be expected to increase both safety and readiness, the Joint Chiefs of Staff argued, and readiness was considered more important. The nuclear weapons in Europe were adequately safe, within the limits of the operational requirements imposed on them. Although the description adequately safe was hardly reassuring, the possibility of America's nuclear weapons being rendered useless during wartime when their locks somehow malfunctioned was more worrisome to the Joint Chiefs. Even if the locking and unlocking mechanisms worked flawlessly, use of the weapons would depend on effective code management. If only a few people were allowed to know the code, then the death of those few or an inability to reach them in an emergency could prevent the weapons from being unlocked. But if the code was too widely shared, the locks would offer little protection against unauthorized use. The Joint Committee's desire for stronger use controls threatened to add complexity and uncertainty to the command and control of nuclear weapons. A State Department official summarized the military's position. All is well with the atomic stockpile program, and there is no need for any changes. The Kennedy administration was far more receptive to the committee's proposals. The former RAND analysts at the Pentagon were familiar with Fred Eclay's work and his recommendation 2 years earlier that locks should be put on nuclear weapons. Jerome Wiesner, the president's science advisor, met with Agnew and agreed that something had to be done about NATO's atomic stockpile. Wiesner was deeply concerned about the risk of an unauthorized or accidental detonation. He had trained as an electrical engineer, briefly worked at Los Alamos, and advised Eisenhower on nuclear issues. Wiesner supported placing locks on the weapons, but had no illusions that locks would completely solve the problem. A skilled technician could open a stolen nuclear weapon and unlock it within a few hours. But Wiesner thought that the locks might help to buy time after a weapon had been taken, stop individual psychotics, and prevent unauthorized use by military forces holding the weapons during periods of high tension or military combat. For Secretary of Defense McNamara, the locks were part of a larger effort to regain not only American control, but also civilian control of nuclear weapons. He felt adamant that the President of the United States should have